defending our digital civil rights.
We need to stop thinking of ourselves as passive users of this technology, and we need to start thinking of ourselves as citizens of the Internet. And if we want the Internet to continue to be a place that we can use to speak truth to power, to advocate for our own rights, we need to fight to make sure that we have sufficient privacy.
That's Rebecca McKinnon. We talk with her about her book, Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. We also replay our 2011 conversation with Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation. It's just been updated and released in paperback. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On April 26, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA. It now moves to the Senate. If passed, CISPA would trump all other federal privacy laws, allowing private Internet companies to hand over confidential customer records and communications to the NSA, the National Security Agency, the military, and other U.S. agencies. During the floor debate, Democrat Jared Polis charged, quote, "the bill goes against every principle this country was founded on." It's not the first, nor in all likelihood the last, assault on the privacy and freedom of Internet users by governments and private companies, both here and abroad. As the Arab Spring has shown, the Internet can be a tool for freedom and democratic expression. But the forces fighting to enclose the digital commons are mobilizing. Companies and governments want to control use for profit and power, and they're using digital technology to corrode civil rights and human rights. Big Brother is watching you. My guest, Rebecca McKinnon, is a champion of digital civil rights. She's co-founder of Global Voices, an international citizen media network, and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where she writes about Internet policy and advocates for Internet freedom. Her book, Consent of the Networked, is about the threats to Internet democracy and the fight to protect it. Rebecca McKinnon, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
This book, Consent of the Network, the subtitle of it is The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. You know, I think many, if not most, Internet users in the U.S., for most of them, the Internet seems very free. You can go anywhere. You can get any information you want. You can post almost anything you want. What are we not seeing when we think it's so free?
Well, there's a global trend towards more and more censorship on the Internet, not only in countries like China and Iran, but also in some democracies like India, for instance. The Indian government is calling for more censorship of social media sites. And even in places like the UK, you have politicians calling for more censorship of social media. And there are a lot of European countries that have national-level censorship mechanisms in place, mainly to deal with things like child porn that everybody agrees are bad, but there are questions about, you know, to what extent can these mechanisms be abused, to what extent can there be mission creep, how can you hold accountable anybody who abuses these systems. There's also an issue of surveillance. As everyone is well aware, the digital platforms and services that we use and that we've come to depend on, of course, are collecting a lot of data about us. And this data is, of course, used for commercial purposes and sometimes resold, but it's also accessed by the government, not only in countries like China, where Internet companies are expected to hand over user information upon request, but you know, law enforcement and national security authorities in this country and across the democratic world, of course, make demands on Internet companies, Internet service providers, wireless companies for data about what people are doing that's been collected. And there's a real question about the extent to which these powers might have been expanded too far. Of course, there are legitimate security concerns. There are legitimate concerns about crime that's committed on the internet. But how do we make sure we address these problems in ways that do not infringe on our rights to privacy, our rights to protection against unreasonable search and surveillance?
I've been around since, you know, I think I got my first Commodore 64 way back in, when was it, the early 1980s, no, about the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I remember thinking, this is incredible that here is a kind of network that is has been given to the world for free by not only the government, but by the defense part of the government, by ARPA. And yet, this is the greatest democratic access to media that has ever happened. And the thought occurred to me then, how long is this going to last?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is an amazing thing. And one reason why it's so amazing is that the engineers who originally invented the internet, while they may have been getting some defense money, were also kind of, you know, 60s hippies in a lot of ways, and believed in, you know, free expression. They designed the network in a very decentralized way. They made protocols that they offered up to the world for free. They didn't try and patent and trademark the basic technical standards that the whole thing ran on, so that people could then innovate and add things to it and use it without having to get permission or having to pay somebody. And, you know, one of the central points of the book is that, you know, the internet, what it is today, what you can and cannot do on it today, the fact that it's globally interconnected, the extent to which you're able to be anonymous, the extent to which you can do things on it, add websites and add applications, innovate on it without central permission. This is all not due to some, you know, natural force. This is because a lot of human beings made specific decisions about the software, about the engineering protocols. Regulators made specific decisions. Lawyers and businesses made specific decisions about how their businesses were going to work. And all of this has added up to the kind of internet we have today. But that can change. And so my argument is that whether or not the internet evolves in the future in a way that remains compatible with democracy, with dissent, with unpopular speech, with whistleblowing, or whether it evolves in a way that makes such things increasingly difficult, really depends on everybody who's shaping the network, including government regulators, including companies, and including the people who use it. And my point is, we need to stop thinking of ourselves as passive users of this technology, and we need to start thinking of ourselves as citizens of the internet. And if we want the internet to continue to be a place that we can use to speak truth to power, to advocate for our own rights, we need to fight to make sure that we have sufficient privacy on these networks, that censorship is constrained because it's really spreading around the world. And you can't assume that it's just naturally going to work out okay just because it's the internet. I mean, it's just kind of like, you know, in your community, whatever city you might live in, if you want your rights to be protected and respected, you want your interests to be protected and respected in your city, if you make no effort to pay any attention to the politics of the city or to what companies and the government are doing, and if you don't push back when you see things happening you don't like, don't be surprised when things don't turn out in a way that is respectful of your rights, you know, that you have to engage if you want your rights to be protected in your physical life, and similarly in our digital lives, if we want our rights and interests to be protected and respected. We're going to have to work for that. We're going to have to push companies to enact policies and practices that are respectful of the kind of digital world we want to live in. We need to push government. You know, we need to pay attention to what kinds of law enforcement and cybersecurity policies and laws are being passed, and are they sufficiently respectful of our privacy and our civil liberties. And I think we saw earlier this year, you know, there was this bill that Congress nearly passed called the Stop Online Piracy Act, and the intent of that bill was narrow. It was meant to just deal with, you know, online copyright violation, but the solutions that were being advocated involved censorship and also involved requiring internet companies and anybody running websites to really monitor what their users were uploading or transmitting to make sure that they don't transmit any copyright infringing content. But that also, that basically results in people having to set up greater surveillance mechanisms, you know, as in the fabric of their businesses. And a lot of civil liberties groups were very concerned about that. And American voters called their congresspeople in very large numbers to say, you know, we may be concerned about intellectual property, but this is not the right way to fight it. I'm concerned about my ability to use the internet in a free manner. And that bill was stopped. And I think that was an example of how people are starting to recognize that we do need to pay attention to these types of issues.
We're talking with Rebecca MacKinnon about her book, Consent of the Networked: The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. You mentioned the word citizens, and in your book, Consent of the Networked, you talk in the book about the digital commons. Here, what you've just talked about is being a net citizen, you know, a citizen of the digital commons, and also copyright, which is all about, in some way, the corporate enclosure of that digital commons. What is the domain that is open to citizenship, and what is the domain that is rendered under the corporate Caesar?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a problem. It's becoming more and more murky. You know, increasingly we are dependent on digital devices, services, and platforms that are owned and operated by the private sector, not only, you know, for our social lives and our businesses and our jobs and our schooling and so on, but also for our political activity. The public square has moved into these privately run spaces. And so there's one question of, you know, to what extent should we try and create more spaces online that are not run by companies, that are more non-commercial, and create a larger commons so that there's more room for the political discourse to happen without having to be concerned about your data being excessively collected for commercial purposes and other issues like that. But at the same time, you're seeing, you know, let's take Facebook, for example. You know, you look at, say, for instance, political campaigns. The Obama campaign reelection strategy is heavily dependent on Facebook. You know, a lot of organizations, activist organizations trying to reach broad swaths of the public are all using Facebook because that's where everybody is. You know, that's where everybody has gone. And so one really important question is, given that the public square and given that our politics have moved into these private domains, if we want democracy to survive in a form that's recognizable as democracy and in a form where controversial speech, unpopular people have the ability to speak out without feeling excessively endangered, do these private companies actually have an obligation to serve the public interest to, you know, some degree? I'm not saying that we should nationalize these companies or, you know, require that every feature on Facebook be put to a vote of all the users, but do we need to have some mechanisms by which we get these companies to commit to core principles on free expression, on privacy, on civil liberties, and that their platforms and services need to be run in a way that is compatible with essentially human rights and compatible with a free public discourse, because otherwise they're going to render you know, the entire sort of political environment unsustainable, or they're going to take it in a direction we don't want it to go. And so just as we expect companies, you know, yes, okay, their primary, you know, the primary business of business is to turn profits and so on, but we also expect that companies have an obligation not to render our air unbreathable or our water undrinkable. We expect companies not to hire 12-year-olds, even though that might make them more profitable, and to respect the rights of their workers, and to not destroy both the environment and the general living conditions of the communities that they operate in. The idea that they need to behave in a sustainable manner is something we expect of companies. And you know, while companies are far from perfect, I think for the most part, certainly American industry does not deny that they have these responsibilities. And I think similarly, we really need to push for companies to recognize that with their power comes responsibility, that they are having an impact ultimately on our political environment, and they need to behave in a way that's sustainable.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rebecca MacKinnon about her book, Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. Isn't one issue, however, that the laws that we have to protect public speech, to protect us from surveillance, weakened though they are becoming, even in the public sphere, operate only in the public sphere, that basically you don't have civil rights. I mean, you may have certain, you know, regulated rights in the workplace that have been won through collective bargaining, but you don't really have civil rights in the workplace. So that the First Amendment, for example, doesn't operate. Could you talk about, say, for example, with the case of WikiLeaks and Amazon, how the government was able to do an end run around civil rights by putting pressure on private corporations to do its bidding?
Yeah, so exactly. This is one of the problems where if you sign up for whether it's your internet service provider or, you know, a Facebook account or a Gmail account, or, you know, if you want to run a website and you need a web hosting service like Amazon Web Hosting, for instance, when you sign up for an account, you're of course agreeing to the terms of service. You have to click agree at some point if you want to set up your account. And generally, you're waiving your rights in those cases. And generally, there will be a list of conditions under which the company can terminate your account. And in the case of Amazon Web Hosting, basically it says the company can terminate your account for pretty much any reason. And so what happened was that WikiLeaks, right around the time that they published the first batch of diplomatic cables, they had their website running out of Sweden, but they had come under heavy hacking attacks, basically. So had decided to move their account to Amazon Web Services because Amazon Web Services has very good security. And so they were running, when they published the cables, they were running their website off of Amazon Web Services. And of course, the publication of the cables upset a lot of people here in the United States, in the U.S. government. And you had a number of American politicians calling for the arrest of Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, and people declaring that what it had done was illegal. And, you know, we put aside the case of the person, Bradley Manning, in the U.S. military who had actually obtained the cables. But the issue around WikiLeaks itself and its right to publish the cables, you know, nobody has brought a legal case against WikiLeaks. Nobody has taken them to court. There has certainly been no conviction or judgment. You know, there is a very strong argument that WikiLeaks has a First Amendment right to be publishing what it published. So despite this, despite that absolutely no legal process had happened, Amazon ended up dropping WikiLeaks as a customer because prominent politicians like Senator Joe Lieberman, said that they should, because essentially it was unpatriotic to be hosting them. The U.S. State Department issued an opinion that WikiLeaks was conducting illegal activity, although, again, nothing was ever even taken to court. No case was even brought. But just based on these opinions of certain members of the U.S. government, Amazon Web Hosting decided that it wasn't worth continuing to do business with WikiLeaks and dropped them as a customer. And what this shows is that when unpopular speech or when political speech of various kinds, controversial speech, is dependent on these commercial services to reach wide audiences, and when these commercial services are under no obligation to uphold First Amendment rights, as you know, Amazon and all these commercial services do not have to do, there is this question of, is that ultimately going to chill our political discourse? Is that going to make it just a little bit harder for unpopular speech to gain a wide audience? And there are a number of other examples that are not as prominent or quite as controversial as WikiLeaks, but show companies making decisions about what they thought was kind of too controversial and not letting it on their services. And one example that I cite in the book is Apple with their App Store. They use their own criteria to decide what is appropriate and what is not appropriate to allow in their App Store. And there was a political cartoonist named Mark Fiore who ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize, whose app was declined. They wouldn't publish his app because he had cartoons making fun of the president, and somebody at Apple decided it was his cartoons were too offensive to be allowed in the App Store, even though the type of speech that Fiore was engaging in is very much kind of standard First Amendment protected political satire. And you see this a lot, that his app was not actually approved until after he got his Pulitzer Prize. There are a lot of other satirists who found that their apps just don't get approved in the App Store because they're considered too controversial or sensitive for various reasons. But, you know, it's up to Apple to decide they can run or not run whatever apps they want. And as increasingly more and more people are using iPhones and iPads as their primary way to get news and get information and get content, and you have a private company like Apple exercising its own criteria of what speech is appropriate and acceptable and what speech is not, and their criteria are much more narrow than the First Amendment and fairly arbitrary, that's a real concern.
And also not to mention the fact that, you know, many of these companies want things from the federal government. They want legislation passed in their favor. So it's kind of scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Yeah, well, there's definitely, certainly a lot of lobbying that's going on all sides.
So is it possible? I mean, these huge commercial companies have built these networks. How is it possible, or is it possible, to push back, not just, let's say, by writing your congressperson, but also even technologically? What are some of the ways that the net citizens can increase their own balance in the balance of power?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different things we can do. I mean, one is we can just become more vocal, and we can, you know, when you're using Facebook, if you're using Google services and you're concerned about what's going on, there are ways to get your voices heard and communicate with the company and let them know that you're not happy and that you may cease to be a user if they do not respect your concerns. I think users do need to get more organized. We need to find more systematic ways of really engaging in collective bargaining between users and the companies. So rather than just kind of creating a Facebook page to say, oh, we don't like this policy, I think we need to, you know, get people more organized and go in and have meetings with the executives and say, look, you know, here are some issues that are really of concern to the network's most vulnerable members, and you need to change this. There's also something called the Global Network Initiative, which is an organization I'm involved with, trying to get companies to basically commit to standards on free expression and privacy and to uphold them. Not many companies have joined, and I think part of the reason is that there hasn't been a lot of public pressure to join. I think there could be a lot more pressure to join from consumers and also from investors. You know, we've seen a lot of investment funds emerge and a growing percentage of pension funds and 401ks invested in socially responsible funds that pick and choose stocks not only on their financial performance, but on whether these companies fit basic criteria on environmental standards and labor standards and other human rights standards. And investors are starting now to look at free expression and privacy and the extent to which companies are respectful of these values in their investment decisions. I think we need a much broader global movement. I mean, we've seen the dial get moved on environmental practices, on labor practices, on other human rights practices, but it's taken a big global movement, you know, people joining organizations and signing petitions and going to marches and really making their concerns known. And I think you're going to have to see that happen with the internet as well. Also, you know, there are tools we can use to protect our privacy and to get around censorship. There's something called Tor. You can download the software at torproject.org. It's an anonymizing tool that works with Firefox. And basically what it does is it not only helps you get around censorship, but it anonymizes your traffic so that when you visit a website, the person who runs the organization running the website doesn't know where you're coming from, can't trace back to who you are. And so that protects you both against commercial tracking as well as government surveillance.
And Drew Adamek just has let me know, our associate producer has a question for you.
As companies like Amazon and Facebook and Twitter become more ubiquitous, their communication technologies become locked in, and the way that we communicate and what we can communicate is determined by the tools that we use. The medium becomes the message. Is there a danger of to democracy and free speech in the way that these forms or these physical structures limit our speech?
Well, I think that's definitely true, and as more and more people are accessing the internet through smartphones as opposed to their PCs, that becomes even more the case, where, you know, unlike on your laptop or your home computer where you can write software programs and kind of install pretty much whatever you want, change the operating system, you know, with something like an iPhone or an iPad, you're kind of stuck with the programs and the systems that Apple wants you to use. You can't change the phone's operating system without rendering it unusable with Apple. And they're determining what apps you can use and what content is on those apps. So that's a real issue. And it's also an issue, too, where you have, as we're moving to more mobile internet, the internet gets less neutral. And on the kind of broadband internet, the internet you use from your computer, there are regulations in place and kind of standards and practices, you know, standard commercial practices that, you know, if you're trying to access YouTube or you're trying to access Rebecca McKinnon's home video streaming service, the access is going to be the same. The company is not going to restrict your access to one platform over the other or make it easier to access one platform or over the other. They're expected to be neutral. But on the mobile internet, you're frequently seeing situations where, for instance, a mobile company will do a deal with YouTube where, you know, if you want to upload videos from your phone, you have to do it through YouTube, and if people want to watch online videos, it's much cheaper to do so, or their data rate is different if they watch the videos from one service than from another. And, yeah, that locks people in. And you're seeing in the developing world, actually, there's something called Facebook Zero, where Facebook does a deal with the local mobile companies whereby if you're accessing Facebook on your phone, it doesn't cost you anything other than whatever your monthly data rate is. But if you're accessing, you know, Human Rights Watch or Rebecca McKinnon's blog, you're paying a per megabyte fee. So that kind of drives people to these big commercial platforms and away from kind of more grassroots nonprofit and kind of citizen created or homemade websites. And that, when it comes to free expression, is quite troubling, especially when Facebook has terms of service that require people to use their real name. Otherwise, you can get kicked off the service. And if you're an activist and you're using a fake name on the platform, it's very likely your enemies will report you for violating the terms of service and you'll get your account deactivated. And there are also a lot of concerns, of course, with Facebook's privacy policies and exposure of people's personal data. So it's very troubling on a lot of levels, which is why we really need to push for more open standards, greater interoperability between different platforms, and why having a robust digital commons that I talk about in the book and non-commercial alternatives and an internet that enables users to access the non-commercial alternatives at the same cost as the commercial services is very, very important.
And, of course, we know that in much of the developing world, it is those mobile networks which are far more used than the at-home network. Rebecca MacKinnon, your book is Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. We've just skimmed the surface of this fascinating and very important book. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much.
Rebecca MacKinnon is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where she writes about the impact of digital technologies on human rights. Go to writersvoice.net to hear her TED Talk and read an excerpt from Consent of the Networked. Next up, we air an encore segment, our 2011 interview with Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation. It's just come out in an updated paperback version. Stay tuned after the break.
My telephone rang one evening, my buddy called for me. Said the bankers all are leaving, you better come round and see. It's startling revelation, they robbed the nation blind. They're all down at the station, no banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. They were all down at the station, no banker left behind. White House they went one day. They was going to call on the president in a quiet and a sociable way. And the afternoon was sunny and the weather it was fine. They counted out our money and no banker was left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. They were all down at the White House. No banker.
This May Day, International Workers Day, the Occupy movement and 99% groups held actions across the country to bring attention to economic inequality and labor rights. The protests focused on a number of labor issues, including the rise in precarious labor, part-time, unbenefited, and freelance workers, as well as unpaid labor, as in internships. Last year, we spoke with Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation. It's a hard-hitting exposé of the spread of unpaid internships, a phenomenon, Perlin says, that's changing the face of labor. The book has just come out in paperback with a new foreword. Here's an extended excerpt from our 2011 interview with Perlin, and you can hear it in its entirety by going to writersvoice.net. You'll also find there an updated conversation I had with the author about efforts to protect interns' rights since his book first came out. Tell us about the scope of this problem. How great an issue is this? How many interns are there? What percent of jobs are being taken by interns?
My best estimate in the book is that there are 1 to 2 million internships each year. But that's really only even just focusing on college students. That is extrapolating from the best estimate out there, that 75% of students at four-year colleges perform at least one internship before they graduate. So just extrapolating from that, you get to something like 1 to 2 million internships each year just in the U.S. In terms of the scope of the problem, I mean, you see internships now across the white-collar world, in just about every industry, every sector, firms of all shapes and sizes. for-profit, nonprofit, government, and now beyond, globally. You're seeing internships spreading across the developed world and even into the major cities of the developing world. So, of course, there are areas like in the blue-collar, you know, the blue-collar world, you don't see intern, garbage men or janitors yet at this point. And then there are a lot of interesting reasons for that. But within the white-collar world, this has become pervasive.
Now, when I started out my radio career, I did an internship in my mid-50s with a, not for this radio show, I was already doing that, but as a freelance reporter. I did an internship with a local NPR station. It was great. I got to produce a series on homelessness. I worked, under the tutelage of the news director. I got a lot of great feedback. I basically learned on the job and didn't have to pay to go to J school. For me, it was perfect. But you say in this book, Ross Perlin, in Internation, that that's not really the experience of most interns.
Well, first off, the use of internships as a kind of career-changing move, I think, is a relatively more recent phenomenon, probably just in the last decade or two. Definitely the core, the archetypal intern is still a college student doing this for a summer or possibly during the academic year. So in the book, I don't get too deep into career change internships because I think that's kind of a fascinating subject in its own right. And I think, you know, to some extent may raise fewer issues in that, you know, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they have a sense already of the labor market. They've been in the labor market. They've worked. And maybe they're more likely to have their own savings. They're more likely to have built up a kind of a support network that could get them through an unpaid experience for a delimited period of time. So I see people in that position as perhaps better able to negotiate the situation than young people.
And yet, that's the kind of interns that were around when I was in college. That's the kind of internship. But you say that the situation has really changed.
Well, in terms of the quality of the experience, I don't deny at all that there are lots of great internships out there, like what you described, things that really represent a kind of shortcut, a kind of way, not in terms of cutting corners, but just a way to really get to where you want to go, and where there's great mentoring, great training, and all sorts of things that then ameliorate the fact that you're not getting paid if. Assuming that this was an unpaid experience in this situation. For paid internships, it's kind of a whole other story. I think there's a lot more merits and in many cases. So yeah, that's one point. The other kind of perhaps more important point that I try to bring out in the book that's less familiar here is it's not that internships are bad or even that most internships are necessarily are bad. I actually want to cast some light on the question of people who can't do internships, the non-interns, the people who can't afford to work without pay. So the situation there is, you know, kind of a larger social question about access to certain professions, about social mobility, about what it means when, you know, basically to go into, say, radio or television or publishing or film or fashion, you need to be ready at some point to work for perhaps several months at the cost of probably several thousand dollars in living expenses during that time, often in expensive cities. Also foregoing the opportunity to earn money, there are those opportunity costs. You need to be ready to do that, and not everybody can afford to do that. And so that has an impact on the makeup of those professions, and it has an impact on who gets ahead in a society that's increasingly dominated by kind of white collar work.
We're talking with Ross Perlin. His book is Internation. It's the first look at this phenomenon of internships, mostly unpaid internships, how that is changing the world of work in the U.S. and, in fact, in the globe. When you say, you talk about the division between those who can do unpaid internships and those who can't as being really something that contributes to social inequality. Why is that? Why is the path to good jobs closed for those who cannot do internships? What is the internship phenomenon?
What is the internship phenomenon? That is the broad question that I try to explain in the book. Where did this come from? Why does the world now work this way? And, you know, to some extent, I think it's a new chapter in the kind of age-old battle between employers looking to save on their labor costs and between especially young people trying to figure out how to enter the workforce, or in general, you know, with workers figuring out what is their bargaining power, what can they ask for, and so. To some extent, it's a story about, you know, employers, especially in these kind of glamour fields, some of which we've just mentioned, which see, you know, huge demand to enter those professions. From their perspective, you know, I think something like one in 16 young Americans wants to become an artist. You know, this is, there isn't room for all of them to actually to do that, at least the way the economy is kind of currently constituted. So the employers realize that they kind of have this advantage, and that they can dictate the terms of entry. And one way in which they do that is by saying, well, you've got to work for me unpaid for a while. You've got to, you know, basically give me a free test drive so that I can see for a period of time, are you somebody that I'm going to want? Even that is perhaps a relatively enlightened attitude compared to some of what goes on, which is simply, employers saying, I'm not even going to be hiring anybody, but, you know, I will let you list me on your CV. You can mention that you had this job. I might give you a recommendation, but there probably won't be any jobs here. But do an internship for me for a while, because I know you need that to get a job elsewhere, somewhere else. So. I think that's a lot of what's going on. I think on the other side, on the side of kind of interns themselves, I think it's a matter of desperation to some extent. I think it's a matter of a changed generational mentality, in which the connection between work and wages has been kind of frayed, and people are used to more things being free. Perhaps, I mean, this is the generation free is supposed to be my generation. You know, that we we're used to internet business models, digital business models in which everything seems to be free. Although, you know, usually there's no free lunch, I think, still, even today. So I think there's been a generational change in mindset as well, such that young people are understanding, perhaps, that this is a pragmatic approach, that they're going to probably have to do this, that they have to take a risk, that they're going to have to, they're already used to doing this at the level of college, going in deeper and deeper into debt with student loans, and seeing that as an investment, so that an internship is kind of another investment on top of that. And they're being encouraged, invest, with this idea, oh, you'll get paid off in the end, it'll work out in the end. And for some people it's true, and for some it's not.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're airing an interview we did in 2011 with Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation. It's just been reissued in paperback with an updated foreword. I spoke with Perlin last week to find out about efforts to protect interns' rights since his book first came out. Those include 3 high-profile lawsuits. You can read all about that by going to writersvoice.net. You go to Disney. You've talked to interns who are there. Talk a little bit about this. This is a major corporation, and we have to say, these kids are getting paid.
Well, the Disney World internship program, which is, as far as I could tell, one of the largest in the world, 7,000 to 8,000 college students each year working at Disney World, an appreciable proportion of the workforce down there. If you go down, the next time you go down to Disney World, I mean, take a look around. The people who are flipping burgers, the people who are picking up trash, the people who are working the monorails, even the people dressed up as Mickey and Donald may well be college interns. And they are getting at least minimum wage. I think Disney is careful enough not to really cross the line into illegal territory there. But what made the program interesting, and the reason that I decided to profile it, was that it's been given this whole kind of academic patina, this fig leaf of educational content, because it has a large advisory board of educators. They actively kind of truck in college credit and work with schools that gain college credit, or the schools that issue college credit. They then charge students who are flipping burgers at Disney to flip those burgers. So it's one of these strange kind of places where you see what Andrew Ross, a professor at NYU, has called the quasi convergence of higher education and the knowledge corporation. And of course, Disney is more an entertainer, but they've understood that people, young people will go down to Florida on their own dime, and in many cases make, you know, barely break even because, you know, they're required to live in Disney housing and they're on the meal plan and they're, you know, they have all these expenses down there and they're making very little. They will do that just to have the Disney name on their CV, and because their colleges are letting Disney recruiters in, their colleges are touting this program and saying, you know, this is one of the great experiences you can have. From Disney's point of view, it's simply a massive labor cost savings. They are able to basically use these interns as a kind of on a rotating basis for, you know, 4 or 5 months at a time to preclude having to hire full-time unionized employees who still, but less and less, make up the bulk of employees down there.
So here we have a situation where universities are giving college credit for kids to work flipping burgers. It seems to me that there's kind of a pervasive corruption of not only the labor relationship, the labor-employer relationship, but also a corruption of the whole notion of what education is about and what college credit is. How does this work? Why are the universities doing this? What are they getting out of it? How did this come about?
I think that's right, that there has been a kind of devaluing of what academic credit is all about and a kind of weakening of the whole idea of training and applied education. From the school's perspective, academic credit represents a revenue stream. When academic credit is attached to something, they charge for it. That is the currency of higher education in some sense. So if a student goes down to Disney and flips burgers, and then there's like a fig leaf sort of course that you know they might have called like marketing U that they would attend a little bit when they're not, you know, when they're not flipping burgers on the side, you know, the school, and of course not every school would do this. There are schools which would not grant credit for the Disney experience, but lots and lots that do. The student might want to get those credits because they can then graduate earlier, or they can say, well, I'm, you know, they can tell their parents, well, I was down there and I got credits as well. It kind of kept things going. For many internships, by the way, this isn't true of Disney. For many internships, the students are required by the employer to get credit in order to indemnify the employer as the employer sees it against a potential lawsuit. So that's another kind of situation where this is even a more serious problem.
And the universities are requiring that students do internships.
That's right. The requirements are coming at students from both sides. For many majors, for many academic programs, the university is requiring students to do the internship. For many internships, the company is saying, you know, students, we're only going to let students do this who can get academic credit, who can go to their colleges and get that kind of approval. So, you know, in terms of the schools and in terms of this as a revenue source, it's a very cheap way to provide academic credit.
Because they don't have to hire professors? Or
it's a form of outsourcing a student's education. You essentially have the student going off campus, spending all their time in an office somewhere or at a workplace somewhere. There, you know, usually there are no classes going on in conjunction with that, no professors needing to be hired, no space on campus that needs to be allocated, all sorts of things like that. And yet schools are charging almost the exact same amount of money to students to go do that. So in terms of how do schools justify this and how do they perceive academic credit, what was fascinating about researching the Disney case was that these professors or these, in some cases, career services personnel from universities who have the relationship with Disney, they spoke of Disney World as a vast learning laboratory such that anything you do there constitutes learning, flipping burgers, picking up trash, etc., that it's all learning. And because it's Disney, you know, this wonderful multinational famous corporation, therefore, just by being with them, you will learn. To me, this represents a very kind of sad change in the notion of what experiential education should be all about. I mean, a wonderful ideal, you know, that harkens back to the late 19th, early 20th century, that education, you know, can happen out in the world. It's not just about sitting in a classroom. You know, there is applied learning. It's a wonderful ideal that, you know, to go out and learn by being in the field and by, you know, and by doing work. But I think that that's been corrupted to the point where people now can justify anything as being experiential education. And what's really kind of added fuel to the fire, I think, is the is the idea that in a more abstract white collar economy where you can't always sort of see the results, or you can't always kind of have a strict, clear, structured training program for everything, as you might with producing widgets, where you could say, okay, this is, the training program constitutes literally just learning this skill. If you're, entering the field of marketing or something like that, it's a little more abstract. So, but that's used as a kind of excuse, I think, to say, oh, well, training, need not be structured. It can just be, throw somebody in there and they will learn, and that constitutes education.
You're hearing a 2011 interview with Ross Perlin about his book, Intern Nation. It's out now in paperback with a new foreword. I guess I feel that that's not even really true in the sense that they can, that these are too vague. It seems to me almost any kind of job where real learning was going on could be structured around doing a project. For example, like the project that I did when I was an intern. It really seems that you're describing a kind of racket. A racket that also, as you've mentioned a couple of times here and now, I'd like to ask you more about it, is actually illegal. So talk about the legal issues that are involved with internships. What's a legal one? What's illegal? And why does it seem that the norm is toward the illegal kind?
I estimate in the book that there are tens of thousands of illegal internships each year in the U.S., just speaking under federal labor law. Not even to mention possibly stricter laws that states would have. Essentially, the law surrounding internships, until very recently, and even now to some extent, it's not well known. It hasn't been very well clarified to people, or it's a little bit murky. But I think it's clear enough. There's basically a 6-point test to which every internship can be kind of subjected and scrutinized that goes back to a Supreme Court decision from the 1940s called Walling versus Portland Terminal. And that test basically laid out what it took to say that somebody should be exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the core piece of labor legislation that protects American workers, that guarantees a minimum wage, that guarantees overtime pay, and also, by the way, things like preventing child labor. So essentially, unless an employer can say that a certain internship meets all 6 of these criteria, they need to pay that intern just as they would any other worker. That intern is entitled to minimum wage, overtime, etc. Now, I think it's truly the rare employer that actually goes through when they're starting an internship program or hiring a new intern and says, do we meet all 6 of these criteria? These are criteria from before the internship boom. They really were thought of in terms of trainees. The idea was, that really these 6 criteria guarantee that unless you're basically running a training program, if you're running a short-term training program, it might be okay not to pay for a short period of time. But otherwise, if you are gaining immediate advantage, for instance, to use the wording of that 6-point test, immediate advantage being essentially, are you asking for real work from the interns? Are you having them perform real tasks that are making money for the company or furthering the business?
Or lowering the costs.
That's right. Or are you helping lower the cost of business for the company? Are you displacing workers? I mean, are these vital tasks? And the vast majority of intern situations that I've found, that is really what's happening. And the employer that's really running a training program, training and recruitment program, where they're bringing young people in and, not making demands from day one, is a rare thing. So I think employers are either, not too aware of the law or simply ignoring it.
So basically the law says that an internship is not for the benefit of the employer. It has to be for the benefit of the intern. It cannot displace any actual workers. It has to be also, isn't that right? It has to be some real learning and training has to be going on. That is, it has to be for the benefit of the intern, as I said. And that's the key thing. So what now has been the response of employers since this has become a little bit better known? What's been the response? Do you think that there's any changes going on in this?
Well, I think, to some extent, there are signs of some employers starting to worry about whether they're in compliance with the law. I know of at least a few cases where employers changed their tune and realized this. But others, I think, have tried to find other strategies. I think the academic credit issue, again, has kind of muddied the waters because, according to some interpretations about this, if a school issues academic credit for an internship, that might sort of tilt the 6-point test in favor of the employer. They can say, well, look, this really was for the benefit of the intern. This really was an educational experience. Look, this university here issued credit. But again, universities are not really applying the 6-point test. Universities are issuing credit willy-nilly, I would say, you know, again, because they have skin in the game. They have an interest. So I think a lot of employers are still kind of waiting on the fence to see what will happen. Will there be any enforcement? In general, there has never been any proactive enforcement on this, even when it's widely known by just about everybody that certain industries and certain companies are offenders. You know, I think most people think that, you know, the Labor Department is far away and, you know, they generally don't do much in this regard, and that young people are too scared or too interested in having people, you know, having their boss as a reference to report anything. So,
and in fact, you point out as well that these interns are not at all under any protection of the labor standards, so that they are ripe for exploitation, for sexual harassment. Talk about some of the gender issues here.
I think one of the most galling things, and much less well known, is the fact that unpaid interns are also not entitled to any of the workplace protections that American workers typically enjoy. So basic civil rights, protection against sexual harassment on the job, you know, sort of fair hiring practices, et cetera, and so on. And the reason is a kind of deep legal one, that they are not counted as employees because they're not getting paid, because the sort of common law definition of an employee has grown up around pay. And so literally, I mean, you have people who are unpaid interns for 6 months in an office working full time. And from the law's point of view, they are just bystanders who happen to be holding down a cubicle, who happen to be sitting there, which is, of course, patently absurd to common sense and absurd from every perspective. So there have been some legal cases, particularly around sexual harassment, because of the creepy gender dynamics and sexual dynamics that often happen with internships, the power dynamics. And in these cases, essentially, courts have thrown out the claim of the intern and said, we're not even going to listen to the merits of this case, or et cetera, because you're not an employee. You don't have any standing in this court. You know, one recent study that I cite in the book found that 77% of unpaid interns were women. What this reflects is the representation of women in the white-collar world and the representation of women in professions where unpaid internships are prevalent and widespread. These fields we've talked about, like film, fashion, publishing, the art world. And so I think this represents a gender issue, and it's never framed and never discussed in those terms. But one thing that I hope will come out of the book is people beginning to think about some of these broader ramifications and these broader issues.
Ross Perlin, talking about his book, Intern Nation, just reissued in paperback. Go to writersvoice.net to read our recent conversation with Perlin about interns fighting back against exploitation since his book came out. Here's a heads up for listeners about a new DVD collection of historical and literary interest. This marvelous series, examining the human condition in literature and thought, is, in their own words, BBC interviews with great novelists and thinkers. The interviews are interspersed with wonderful archival footage and commentary, and feature such novelists as Virginia Woolf, Aldous Huxley, Elizabeth Bowen, and T.H. White. On the thinker side, among others, there's Sigmund Freud, the only audio interview he ever gave, at least in English, Margaret Mead, and in an especially fascinating segment, Stanley Milgram. He's the guy who did that famed experiment that found that 60% of his very ordinary subjects were willing to torture victims when instructed to do so. I was spellbound watching these episodes and hungered for more at the end. You can find out more by going to athenalearning.com or go to Writer's Voice for a link. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.